If I'm too quiet, then shout or wave or something. I'm rarely accused of being too quiet, but you never know. And if I stand in the way so you can't see, then similarly make some comments. So just a very brief introduction to what I'm going to talk about, which is the sort of science and some other aspects about the use of genetically modified insects. So I'm sure you've had some sort of talks or discussion or something about genetically modified foods, which tend to lead to fairly polarized opinions, and possibly also other uses of genetic engineering in the context of insulin and vaccines and other health applications, which are relatively well accepted to the point they're not usually called genetic modification or whatever, recombinant insulin and recombinant vaccines, which means the same thing, but somehow is treated differently. And I'm going to talk about genetically modified insects, which have not been widely used, but as you see, have had some, you know, are moving towards the field and indeed have had some field use on a limited scale. So why would anybody want to do that kind of thing? And this is the very short version of the talk, which will then be expanded to a few more slides later. So briefly, why would you want to do it? Well, pest insects cause a lot of damage, huge amounts of agricultural damage, destroying crops, spreading diseases, that kind of thing, of plants and livestock, and also of humans, so malaria and dengue and a whole host of other human diseases spread by mosquitoes and other biting insects. And so that's the harm, that's the thing we'd like to do something about. And the method that I'm going to talk about is specifically the use of engineered, sterile, loosely defined, I'll tell you what I mean by that, male insects to try to control the population. So the technology underlying it is genetics and molecular biology, but when you go out and use it in the field, there's ecology and epidemiology and indeed social science and how people respond to this suggestion. And how far have we got? Well, we've gone out into the field with some of these pests starting in 2009 in the Cayman Islands and also Malaysia and Brazil. So that's the short version. You can skip to the questions, but I have a little more detail if you like. The best-known mosquito-borne disease, of course, is malaria, but the one I'm going to talk about primarily is dengue. Much less well-known, but actually the second most important mosquito-borne disease and the most important viral disease. So dengue is a virus or a set of viruses. It is, unusually for an infectious disease, it's increasing in incidence and severity around the world. It is in very broadly spread, distributed now in subtropical regions. And this is the map of dengue risk, but that's pretty much the same as the map of the distribution of this mosquito, Aedes aegypti, which is the one that transmits dengue. There are a couple of minor vectors, some other species that can transmit, but this is by far the most important one. So dengue is a virus disease, there's no vaccine, and there's no therapeutic drugs, and there's no prophylactic drugs. If you go to somewhere that has malaria, you'd be told to take your tablets in advance, protective prophylactic drugs, that will probably protect you from the malaria. And conversely, if you get malaria, there are therapeutic drugs with which to treat it. And the other thing that would probably be told if you go to a malaria area is to sleep under a bed net. And that doesn't work against this mosquito either, because this mosquito bites primarily in the daytime. So sleeping under a bed net won't protect you. So that rather limits the options for controlling this disease. So the reality of dengue control is this. This is dengue control. So it's all based around control. This is no drug, no vaccine, so it's all around controlling the mosquito. So how do we control the mosquito? You can look for its breeding site, so you can try to kill the immatures, or you can try to kill the adults. And killing the immatures means going and finding their breeding sites, but this is a container breeder. It breeds in small pools of clean water, discarded Coke cans, buckets, that kind of thing. Very urban, human-associated mosquito. So if you think about where those sites are, this is one backyard in Brazil. How many separate little pools of water are there, or might there be, in that one backyard? Okay, and then so the citizens or the inspectors have to go around and find every single one of those and treat them. And so treating an individual one is easy. You just tip it out and kill the larvae or put a chemical in or something, but you can't find enough of them. You can't find enough of them to get enough mosquitoes to stop dengue transmission. And then the alternative is to go for the adults, which is space spraying, which is basically to fill the entire volume of space with an aerosol of a toxic chemical to try to kill the mosquitoes. Not an especially environmentally friendly approach, as you can imagine, but also not very effective because the mosquitoes hide pretty efficiently indoors and so on from this kind of spray, as do people. And that's it. So the sort of underlying motivation for the research that I'm going to talk about is essentially that we have to be able to do better than that, and we need to be able to do better, or at least differently from that. Because even these methods are themselves under threat from resistance to the chemical insecticides in the mosquitoes. So this is mosquito reproductive biology. Okay, boy meets girl, sing a little song to each other, and in the normal way of things, you get lots of little baby mosquitoes, and so the population continues and expands. They really do sing little songs to each other. Okay, and then what if we could do something to this male so that, although still meets the girl, sings songs, whatever, she does. We've done something to the genetics of this male so that is inherited by the progeny that means they don't develop through to adult. And then there'll be fewer mosquitoes in the next generation than there would have been. And if we can get enough of the wild females to mate our special males, then we can control the target population. And that's the method. And it has a number of features, and two of them I'll highlight here. One is that it's extremely species-specific, so that the males will mate only with females of the same species, not even with other species of mosquito, let alone other insects that might be in the environment, which might be beneficial or just neutral, making their own living, or endangered, or mythical, or whatever, won't be affected by this approach. So it's exquisitely species-specific, and no toxic residues, and so on. So very environmentally friendly in that respect. And the other feature of it is that these males will go out and look for the females. They'll actively seek out the females to find them and mate with them in a way that no chemical is ever going to do. So that there's and that means that particularly when the population is low, you can find those last ones much more effectively with this kind of method, potentially, than you can with a chemical, for example. And this might all sound revolutionary, but it isn't. In fact, it's not a new idea at all. It's been around for 50 years. Using radiation-sterilized insects. And so this is New World screwworm. This is a bit of a dinner time conversation, so we won't go too much into what the insect does, except that it lays its eggs in wounds in livestock and animals, and the larvae burrow their way into the animal and kill it, which is all very messy. So, bad pest. It was present in the southern United States, and it was eliminated in a rolling program of release of radiation-sterilized screwworm. So exactly what I was talking about, but using radiation to sterilize the insects. And then they realized that they'd just fly back across the border from Mexico, so they carried on down through Mexico, and then down, as shown here, through Central America, all the way down to Panama. So this nasty pest insect was eliminated from a continent by this method. So you can do it on very, very large scales. And South America remains infested, and reinvasion from the south is prevented by continuous release of sterile insects in a buffer zone in Panama, which is, of course, the geographic narrow point, so they can't reinvade back into this protected area. There are a few limitations with radiation, and one of them is that the females have a choice. There's wild males out there, and there's your sterile males, and you want enough of the females to mate your sterile males. But that means that they have to be sexy male screwworm or mosquitoes or whatever that means, and which is quite hard for humans to recognise, actually. But what you want to do is this. So you want to radiate the male and generate random dominant lethal mutations, chromosome damage in the sperm. So when sperm fertilizes the egg, that inherited damage is enough. Damage inherited from the male is enough to kill the offspring. And that's what we call sterility in the context of radiation sterility. That's what you want to. But you can't target the radiation just on the sperm. So you radiate the whole fly. And that means that that damages the rest of the cells of the fly. And so to turn it around, what you're saying is you're going to fry this with radiation to the point at which it's sterile, and then expect it to go out and compete for mates on an equal basis with wild males. And of course it can't, because you just fried it with radiation, which is a rather fundamental limitation. Now that program did work, and other big programs have worked for some other flies, but in more technical terms, it means you have to be able to find a sterilizing dose of radiation that will not be too incapacitating for the insect. And for many insects, you can't do that, and specifically for mosquitoes, it turns out to be very hard. So this radiation-based method, although nice in principle, has been a problem for mosquitoes particularly. So then, coming to the genetic engineering, what if you could have the same effect, so that the dominant lethal mutation, but engineered into this male, so it's homozygous in the jargon, has two copies of this gene, mates with the female, all of these inherit one copy of the gene from their father, and that one copy is enough to stop this individual developing, in other words, kill it, then you can reproduce this, but without using radiation. And so without having the damaging effect of radiation on the insects. Now, a couple of flaws with this plan that you may have immediately spotted, which I just said one copy is enough to kill them. So how do you make the insects that have two copies without them being dead? So of course you have to be able to turn it off in some way, and we arrange that you can turn off this genetic system by giving it by putting in a chemical antidote. And so if you grow them in the on diet or that contains the antidote, then they will survive. So we can grow large numbers of them. You also incidentally have to arrange that these males, once you've released them, no longer have an ongoing requirement for the repressor, because otherwise you grow large numbers of them, put them out of the factory door, they no longer have the repressor, or keel over and die, and that isn't very useful either. Okay, and because this is genetic engineering, we could be a little more sophisticated. We can say, well, what if we just kill the females? And then that has some particular consequences, and what if we kill them later in development or earlier in development and so on. I won't go into all those details, but they have particular consequences that are generally advantageous in terms of the biology of the insect. And so this is a genetic strategy, but it's just one amongst many genetic strategies. And so to sort of classify genetic strategy, you say, what are you trying to do? And then some characteristics of the genetics. So what are we trying to do? With this method, we're trying to suppress the target population, which is what you would try to do with insecticides. It's what you try to do with a fly swat. I mean, it's a pretty normal way of trying to control insect populations. But something else that you might have heard talk about that's in some ways more sophisticated and consequently harder and consequently hasn't gone out into the field yet except in one particular instance. What if you could make the mosquitoes less harmful? So what if you could say, we'll somehow convert that wild mosquito population into a form that can't transmit malaria or dengue? And then it'll still be out there and people still be bitten by it, but it won't transmit malaria, and so that's a lot less bad. So that's, you know, what are you trying to do is one kind of classification. Another one is, what do you expect the genes to do? So, of course, sterile insect methods are very self-limiting. The gene is lethal or sterile or something like that, has some huge fitness penalty associated with it, and so it will disappear from the environment very quickly if you stop releasing them. And it's only maintained, those sterile males are only maintained by periodically releasing more, maybe every week, something like that. If you were to stop releasing them, those males would die and the gene would disappear very quickly. But for this, if you want to convert the population into a less harmful form, you need that gene to persist in the environment and stay out there and maybe spread, maybe increase in frequency in the area of the release and maybe spread geographically beyond that release point. And those systems are then called self-sustaining or invasive genetic systems. And there are examples of both types. So what I'm going to talk about, the system that we call RIDDLE, which is this engineered sterility system, is clearly aimed at suppressing the target population and it's clearly self-limiting by the nature of its fitness penalty. But there are examples of the other types around. Okay, so then that's the sort of theory, and then what do you do in terms of testing these things? Well, of course, you do enormous amounts of laboratory work to get a strain that has the properties that I've just described, which are not trivial to produce. And then you sort of, having done all that, you head out into the field, having talked to regulators and people and all that kind of thing. And I'm mostly going to focus on this end, but I wouldn't want you to think that there hasn't been an enormous amount of laboratory work behind it. So how do we do it? Well, this is my one slide on molecular biology, all right? And it's only at this level of detail. But how do you get a lethal system that's repressible and sex-specific and all that kind of stuff? Well, it's actually relatively, in principle, it's relatively straightforward. So it's all built around this gene called tetracycline repressible transcriptional activator. And what it does is exactly in that name. So first of all, it binds to a specific DNA sequence. And when it's there, it activates a gene cloned suitably adjacent to that. And if that's something that will disrupt the cell in which it's expressed, and that cell is an essential cell, an essential tissue, then that'll lead to death. And so then this little package is a lethal genetic system, and dominant lethal if it's strong enough. So that's fine. And then the second part, repressible, well, the final key property of this protein is that it binds tetracycline, or molecules of the shape of tetracycline, in very high affinity, and the tetracycline-bound form doesn't bind DNA. So if it doesn't bind DNA, it doesn't bind expression of the effector, then they don't die. So then that's then effectively an antidote to this system, and then we have repressible dominant lethality. So if you just add tetracycline to the diet of these insects as they're growing up, then they won't die, and if you don't, then they will. And so, of course, in the wild, in the field, where these mosquitoes are growing up in someone's backyard in a bucket at the bottom of the garden, of course they don't get tetracycline, and so you get the lethal effect. And if you want to make it female-specific, which I mentioned earlier, then you need to add some female specificity somewhere. And an obvious way would be to use a female-specific promoter, which is a regulatory part of a gene that means the whole thing is only on in females in the first place. And then females die. So to give you an example of that, but not using something that kills them, just something that fluoresces. So this is a reporter widely used in molecular biology to say, where is something expressed? So this is a fluorescent portrait. It'll glow in the, when it in cells and tissues when it is expressed, and not, of course, when it's not. So we took control elements from a female-specific gene that's expressed only in flight muscles, which we identified, and put it here. So that drives the whole thing. So it should be expressed in females and flight muscles through this system. So it should be tetracycline repressible. And how did it express this fluorescent reporter? And this is what we got. So you can see, in the absence, grown in the absence of the antidote, females have this really strong fluorescence here under a fluorescence microscope, which for those, which is right here, which is in the thorax, which is where the flight muscles are. Males grown without the antidote don't show that fluorescence, so it's female-specific, sex-specific. And if when we grow them in the presence of the antidote, the presence of tetracycline, they no longer glow. So it's switchable, so it's repressible. Okay. So what would happen if we use not just not a neutral reporter here, but something that would affect, actually affect the function of the flight muscles? So these are males of that type. Sounds irrelevant. These are males of that type. They sit around and don't do very much until you poke them, which you may think is a male characteristic, but that's what these mosquitoes do. And then when you do, they buzz around pretty happily. And they are, in fact, completely normal, as far as you can see from here. Of course, they have a little gene in them, but it doesn't really affect them at all. They're males. Females, on the other hand, so what's going to happen? Can't fly. Okay? They can jump a bit. That's a different set of muscles. That's muscles in the legs. But they can't fly. And they can't fly because we expressed a gene in the female flight muscle that disrupts their flight. But it's tetracycline repressible, so if we'd grown them on the antidote, they would have been fine. Okay? So we have here the set of phenotypes we wanted. And flightlessness equals death in the field, because if a mosquito emerging from this little pool, if it can't fly away, it can't avoid predators, ants, these sorts of things. It can't fly and bite somebody. And in fact, it can't mate, even in the laboratory. When I said they sing little songs to each other, they really do, and they do it by modulating their wing beat frequency, and the females can't do that, so the males ignore them because they don't recognise them as female mosquitoes, so they can't mate. Males, on the other hand, are normal. And we've done some trials with those where we put them to big cages and targeted wild populations with them, and we can suppress, our collaborators showed that they could suppress cage populations of mosquitoes by periodic release of such males. But I'm going to show you some other things where we actually went out into open field. But bring a new technology like this to the field, there is more to it than having a technical system, a strain that does what you want it to do, as I just showed you. Quite a lot more. And regulatory aspects and community aspects are part of that. I'm not going to talk too much about the regulations, just to say we have done a lot of this and we've imported our strains into a whole range of countries. Open release in some, and a bunch more countries looking at this. Most countries have some sort of regulatory framework for genetically modified organisms, usually phrased in the context of crops, because that's the best known one, and sometimes vaccines and that kind of thing. But it, you know, it covers these kinds of things and can be adapted for it, sometimes quite smoothly, sometimes less so, but still some sort of regulation. Now, people ask a lot of questions about this sort of technology, about the genetics, the ecology, and so on. And I won't go through all these in all that detail, but it is on the backside of this yellow,
blue
sheet in front of you if you want to read it in the break. But clearly questions, you know, regulators and public are interested in questions, you know, so what happens if you're bitten by a genetically modified mosquito? What happens if a scavenger or a predator eats it? What happens if you're successful and you suppress the target population? Does that mean that there were things out there that depended on it that are now going to be short of food? Was it filling a niche that some other mosquito is going to replace? What's it going to cost to do it? And how does that compare with other interventions? All those kinds of things. And I've just got one or two sort of comments on some of those on the back of that without going into that in enormous detail. Obviously, those are very reasonable topics for discussion if you want to, but there are plenty of other things as well. On the community side, what do people think about the idea of controlling this dengue-transmitting mosquito in the area where they live? In other words, releasing thousands or indeed millions of genetically modified mosquitoes in their area. Well, when we got into that, it was a bit of an unknown. So the only way to find out is to go and ask. And so this is actually from our project in Brazil. And we, which means our Brazilian collaborators, because they speak, they're local and know the people and all that kind of thing, and also, as a small technical point, speak Portuguese, which I don't, which is quite important in Brazil. A whole bunch of presentations, slightly more formal, sort of city hall, town hall type meetings. with the local government and people. A lot of TV and radio. A lot of this is on the web, although in Portuguese, if you want to see it. And so a lot of that's quite general, but some of it's very culture specific. And one thing is, what do people know to start off with? So actually, people in dengue endemic areas know a lot more about dengue and the mosquito and the, you know, so only females mosquitoes bite and males don't. Not everybody knows that, but in dengue endemic countries, a lot more people do that. And that's really important. If you're going to say we're going to release large numbers of sterile male mosquitoes, we only release males, we don't release females. And you know, that makes a lot of sense if you think that females bite and males don't, but if you don't know that, it doesn't make a lot of sense. So the background level of knowledge varies enormously, as does how you put information over. This is Carnival, big thing in Brazil. And so, you know, they use particular kinds of fans in a particular way, and we have people dressing up as mosquitoes and spreading the word and all that kind of thing, which works really well in Brazil and probably wouldn't work so well in Oxford. So, you know, very sort of culturally contingent, a lot of this stuff. And formal written information and all that kind of thing, and then visiting houses, our trap and monitoring method involves eventually going into people's houses and vacuum cleaning them for mosquitoes, which is quite intrusive sort of thing. Everybody's very happy with it. To the extent that in the trial area in Brazil, I think we had 88% of the houses had a gave us permission, and the other 12% didn't have an adult present, and that was it. We had nobody said no. Nobody we could go to and had an adult present said no. With all that publicity, everything I showed you, they have had no negative comments about the genetic engineering aspect of this project. Probably wouldn't be the same if you tried it in Europe. Again, that's sort of thing that varies from one culture to another. And the press was a lot of international press interest in this, and mostly pretty positive. And we were the cover story of New Scientist end of last year. So to go back, that regulatory community stuff is very important, and I'm happy to talk more about it, but just talk briefly about the technical side. So the first time we went out with these mosquitoes into the field was in the Cayman Islands, which is a set of islands in the Caribbean, right here. And this is Grand Cayman, the biggest of the Cayman Islands. And our trial was right here at the east end of the island in a settlement imaginatively called East End, at about a 40-hectare site. This method, even if it works as well as I could imagine, as well as I could hope, is not a magic bullet that would solve all the world's ills or even all the world's dengue ills. And we would anticipate using it in conjunction with other existing control methods in an integrated pest management program. However, to see whether the method would work in this context, we went out using it on its own without any other interventions around. That would not be the most efficient way to use it, but if you want to show that it works as a standalone, that's really the way to go. And essentially, we took an area of the site and released a lot of mosquitoes into it to see what would happen in that site to the target population versus another population on the coast, and indeed the other end of the same site, which is only about 500 metres away, but these mosquitoes only fly about 100 metres, maybe two at the maximum. And this is what happened. So this in green is area C here, untreated. And in A is area A. Sorry, in red is area A, which is the area in which we were releasing the mosquitoes. And this mosquito population is driven by rainfall, so they're very dependent on rain. And it's dry over here, and then it rains a bit more, so the population increases. And then this is the one where we were doing the intervention, and you can see it's suppressed. And it's suppressed to about this kind of level, which on this overtrap index, which is a measure of population density, is about 10%. Versus about 50% for the target population. So that's about an 80% reduction in this measure, overtrap index, which is not a linear measure, so it slightly underestimates the true reduction. But if we say 80%, that's still fantastic, frankly. So that's more than happy with that. So periodic release of these males suppressed the target population. Despite no control, we got suppression in a couple of months. This is not an immediate control method. So the males you release don't do anything to the females except mate with them, and they affect their offspring, not those females. So there's not an immediate impact from release, and you don't expect that. It's a long-term suppression thing, not a sort of instant knockdown approach. And the males were competitive. This is a big issue. So these males, if you think about it, I said radiation damages the males, and then so implicitly this is going to be better, but is it really? Because there's a whole bunch of things that affect these males. You've taken them out of the field and colonised them in the lab. You've kept them in the lab for probably 10 years or more, so 100 plus generations, something like that, which would be from us back to the Romans, maybe, in human terms, something like that, in the lab. They've been kept in cages no bigger than 30 centimetres, so the males have never had to go more than 30 centimetres to find a female. They've had no predators. They've been given food. Their behaviour may have changed. Their genetics, inbreeding and drift. They've been given an artificial diet. Physically separated, a handled lot, taken out into the field, and dumped out into the field with no thought about where the wild females are, and you still expect them to mate properly in the field with wild females. And they do. They're not as good as wild ones, but as we measured it, they were about half as good or something like that, which is fantastic. And the programs that have been done successfully with radiation have worked with insects that are 1/100th as good as a wild one. So that's it was remarkable how good they were. But the better we can get them, the better. And so a big question is, how do you recognise fit, happy, healthy, sexy male mosquitoes? So we want to produce large numbers of cheap, high quality, which means sexy, male mosquitoes. And we can tell that they're male, and we can tell that they're cheap, and we can tell how many of them there are, but we can't tell how good they are, except at the very best by what you might call a bioassay, which is to say put them in with a bunch of females and see what happens, which is not, you know, not an ideal kind of assay. And some sort of proxy, some way of recognising fit, happy, healthy, sexy male mosquitoes would be extremely helpful in this area. As traditionally, it's easy to thank all the people that have been involved. We're a little company based in Melton Park, spin out from Oxford University, classic biotech company with venture capital backing and funding from the Grand Challenges in Global Health and so on. And you know, we can't go to another country and release a bunch of mosquitoes, so everything we do is in conjunction with people in the collaborators in those countries, usually government entities. So this was the Cayman Islands Government Mosquito Research and Control Unit that we did the Cayman Islands stuff with. And I mentioned the Brazilian project, which is in conjunction with a public company and University of Sao Paulo, their premier academic institution there, and so on and so on. Everything is working with other people. And that's it. Thanks.
Minute break, and then we'll reconvene for the discussion. So I'll get my help to come around and whatever they've got, and a hat. Thank you very much.
Oh my gosh.